Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business number 52. This week's podcast is brought to you by Checkpoint Software and hosted, as always, by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting. We've got a Risky Business exclusive this week. Security researcher and a regular Risky Biz guest Adam Boileau has released the source code to his 2006 Windows Firewire attack for the benefit of our listeners. So if you've ever wanted to play around with unlocking password-protected Windows workstations, now you can. Just go to itradio.com.au/security and click through to the project page where you can get your grubby little hands on that software. More on that soon, including an interview with Boileau himself. Now, Checkpoint has sponsored this week's show, so we'll be chatting to Fred Boyerson from that company in this week's sponsor interview. He'll be giving us an update on data loss disclosure laws reform here in Australia. It now looks almost certain that we'll soon have laws here requiring Australian businesses to come clean if they lose customer records. He'll tell us what it all means. But first, as always, it's time for the news with Manir Katadia from ZDNet Australia. Now, Manir, we've seen a little bit more fallout from this frozen RAM attack with Apple's keychain software being affected.
Yeah, that's right. Basically, if you have access to an Apple machine, then you can go and have a look and see the keychain passwords.
Yeah, now that's it. Look, with all of these frozen RAM attacks, there's a bunch of ifs.
Yeah,
when it comes to exploiting them. And I believe in this case, you need to have recently used Keychain.
Yep.
For those people out there who aren't Mac users, Keychain is basically just a password storage and retrieval utility. So it remembers your passwords for websites and all sorts of applications so that you don't have to, which is quite convenient. But the problem is, apparently, when Keychain pulls a password out and then uses it in an application, it doesn't actually destroy it immediately, which means that you can recover the password from RAM.
That's right. And you can actually even recover if it's been off for a short amount of time.
Yeah, well, that's the whole Princeton cold boot attacks. For anyone who's not familiar with them, I suggest you download last week's program because we went into it in some detail. But basically, researchers have found that you can pull RAM out of a computer and most of the contents of that RAM remains readable for a couple of minutes, even if you've pulled power to it. So
this isn't really a dangerous thing, though, is it?
Well, no, but I mean, it's kind of dumb coding, though, on Apple's behalf to actually pull a password out of, you know, this ultra-encrypted, secure environment and then just leave it floating around in RAM in clear text.
Yeah, I guess so. That's not so smart.
No.
But you do need, like, you know, physical access to the machine in order to be able to go and do all of this. I mean, you can't do it remotely at all, can you?
No, no. And I guess it's, you know, it's kind of a reassuring thing for us that physical access bugs like this are actually becoming newsworthy. So good sign of the times, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, but I'm still leaving the piece of tape over my eyesight camera.
Yeah, probably a good move. They are watching you. They are watching you, Apple users. Now, I just picked this one out. This is a little bit outside of our normal news brief, but the White House has, and I love this, lost millions of emails pertaining to the Iraq war.
That's right, between 2002 and 2005.
Whoops.
They're all gone.
They're all gone. Yeah, and I believe there's some pretty strict email retention policies and law that those guys are subjected to. Is that right?
As far as I know, yeah. You know, they're pretty serious over there. But they've lost them all. I guess maybe some of these archiving vendors ought to give the White House a call.
Yeah. Now, what I thought was funny is the White House Chief Information Officer, Theresa Payton, assured the committee that her office is working actively on a multi-step restoration process. Now, this is what kills me, right? She said she felt comfortable that disaster recovery backup tapes could be used to locate missing emails, adding that process would be time-consuming and could cost at least $15 million.
That's quite funny, that. But what? We are talking millions of emails over years and years.
Yeah, but $15 million to grab some stuff off tape? Does that sound a little bit sus to you, Manir?
Well, the whole bloody story does, to be honest.
Yeah, so, you know, a separate issue under scrutiny and revolves around charges that Karl Rove, he was one of those, you know, senior Republican Party appointed dudes who was all about bombing Iraq, yay. him and about 50 other presidential advisors were using Republican National Committee accounts to conduct official business so as to subvert federal record keeping laws. So this is really could be a case of, you know, people within the White House in America not actually adhering to their own compliance rules.
Well, either they did and then just lied and deleted them all afterwards. I mean, you know, what do you believe?
Well, it's a bit sus, isn't it? It's just not nice.
No, it's not.
Okay, moving on. Now, we don't normally do bug stories, but this one is worth reporting on. Manir?
Yeah, we're talking about VMware, right?
Yep, VMware it is.
That's right. They have failed to fix a critical severe bug in its virtualization software. And cool thing was the revelation came out just days before VMware's big event, the VMworld in France.
Yeah. Now, I went to VMworld in 2006 and that was in LA. I mean, why couldn't I have gone when it was in France?
I think I'd rather be in the States, actually.
Really? The France? Oh, but that's because you're English. You got that whole, like, you know, Sydney-Melbourne rivalry thing going between London and Paris, right?
Yeah. It's a lot worse there between England and France. So.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone hates the French. What's with that? Hi, incidentally, to all of our French listeners.
Yeah, hello.
Hello, bonjour. But yeah, look, the guys who make the, you know, Core Security, who make that vulnerability scanner, those guys like are frighteningly together. They're releasing some software that demonstrates a problem. But, you know, we've seen Microsoft actually become quite responsive to security glitches, and now it's all of these other large vendors like Oracle, Apple, and now VMware who are copping a bit of flack in the press for not attending to bug reports when they should.
Well, it's about bloody time. I mean, you know, virtualization is such a big deal at the moment. VMware is such a big player in that area. And we haven't heard too much about security and virtualization. And I think it's really, really important. And, you know, for so long, we've been looking and researching. And I got my reports out saying, you know, let's look for these security issues in virtualization. And there hasn't been too much there. So I'm glad these are coming out because it's obvious it wasn't perfect.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think from what I understand, the hypervisor itself is actually pretty secure, but it's all of the management stuff that they've built around it and a lot of the features that that's where people are tilling for bugs because there's a lot more code. And this particular bug allows attackers to create or modify executable files on the host operating system. So it's like, you know, bad.
It's pretty serious, yeah.
Yeah, and it's that's as a result of weaknesses in VMware's shared folders feature. So, you know, basically anyone out there who's using VMware, I mean, they're vulnerable to this. There's a lot of them. I mean, Microsoft was saying recently that virtualization is overhyped because only 1 in 10 new server deployments were on VMware, you know, on virtualized platforms. But dude, that's 10% of the global, you know, of servers running globally are running on VMware at worst. So, you know, that means that chances are we've got a bunch of listeners out there who are running VMware. The guys from Core are about to demonstrate this vulnerability. It's only a matter of time before someone actually figures out the exploit code and puts it out there on the net. And bad news, man. Bad news.
Totally, totally. I hope VMware goes and sorts this out pretty bloody quick.
Well, it'll be interesting because this is like it's really been a recent thing that they've started getting hammered over their security stuff. So we'll see if they do what Oracle do and just ignore criticism.
I hope not. Come on, they can't do that. They've got to learn.
Well, we hope so. So we'll see if that happens. Or they could do what Microsoft did and bite the bullet, hire a bunch of really cluey guys and, you know, just get their shit together.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, now this final item, and it is a shorter news segment than normal this week. This final item is just a bit of a classic. Now, it's fiercely bloody technical. But basically, it looks like YouTube dropped off the entire internet for 2 hours as a result of someone in Pakistan misconfiguring a bunch of routers.
This is really, really funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Pakistan basically decided that they wanted to censor YouTube and block it. And, go on, you explain the techie stuff. It's a bit over my head.
Okay, it looks like it was a BGP. That's a, what is it, Border Gateway Protocol? I think it's like one of those weird routing protocols that's like way below IP. And it's... and it's one of those things that people don't quite understand right yet. So there was a major ISP in Pakistan that had three options for blocking YouTube from Pakistan. They could have deployed access control lists on all of their routers, dropping packets, you know, all of that, which would have been a real pain in the bum. They could have statically routed all three YouTube IPs or that entire subnet to a null or discard interface on all the routers on their network, or they could have used a BGP black hole function, right? And that's what they did. So they did this big BGP announce, which wound up being swallowed by basically the entire internet instead of just their downstream stuff.
So what happened here is that everyone who was trying to contact the YouTuber, the routers tried to go via Pakistan, right?
Well, pretty much, yeah. So what wound up happening is because of this dodgy BGP announce, It tricked a lot of core routers across the globe into thinking that YouTube was actually in Pakistan.
It's a good trick.
It's a great trick. And I'm sure, you know, there's going to be more about this later. There's a link. I'm going to post the link, actually, with the post to this podcast for listeners who are interested. But there's a link to a blog post by...
Are you talking about the Arbor Networks one?
Yeah, by Danny McPherson, who works for Arbor Networks. And, this stuff is way over my head, but it's really worth a look. So
it's very, very interesting stuff. And if you understand it, then, please leave a post and explain what's going on properly.
Yeah, like if you guys work, if there's anyone listening who works for a telco or an ISP or who manages like a large bunch of routers, some pretty hardcore routers, and they want to see some of the stuff that can happen as a result of BGP dodginess, definitely go to the website itradio.com.au/security and click on that link. And
I'd be really interested to know if this could be used. I mean, you know, we've got all these people with massive botnets and stuff. I mean, why bother if you've got access to one of these routers? Then
Need to bother. That's what I'm kind of thinking. I mean, if BGP is really configured that badly upstream, then, you know, you'd think maybe some guys could actually, you know, if they pwn the right ISP, mm-hmm. then they can probably fiddle around with the BGP stuff and start tarpinning people without actually having to to do much. That could be bad. But then again, the mitigating factor is, you know, if people actually start tightening up the way that they use BGP, this won't be a problem anymore. But, you know, people don't usually do what they should, do they?
They hardly ever do.
Yeah, and you're feeling better this week, mate? You were off sick last week?
It took a good few days to get over it, but yeah, much better now.
Okay, well, it's good to have you back on board, mate, and we'll speak again next week.
Excellent, look forward to it.
Mania Katadia there with this week's news, and you can read all of those stories on zdnet.com.au. I should mention that a news item that appeared last week in Risky Business has turned out to be much ado about nothing. Researchers claim to have broken GSM encryption with some new tools, and they made a really big fuss about it. As it turns out, that sort of technology has been around for eons. It's cheap and very effective, and I'd just like to thank Les Goldsmith from ESD Group Australia for the heads up on that. He gave me a call. Thanks, mate. Now it's time for this week's mega-exclusive feature interview with Adam Metalstorm Boileau. He is well-known to listeners of Risky Business. He's the lead Canvas developer at Immunity Inc. and an all-round superstar when it comes to pulling innovative new attacks from where the sun don't shine on a fairly regular basis. One of the most relevant current attacks he came up with was the work he did in breaking into locked Windows XP workstations by manipulating their memory through their FireWire interface. It's a pretty simple attack, really, to use in practice. You take a computer with a FireWire port loaded with Atom software, plug it into a locked Windows system, and hey presto, it'll overwrite the password protection code in the target system's memory and you're in. Simple as that. No word on whether or not Vista is vulnerable to this one yet, but he just hasn't looked into it. Well, with the recent cold boot attacks making headlines over the last couple of weeks, Atom thought it was time to release his attack tool to the public. And Risky Business is pleased to announce that exclusively today. Now, if you haven't heard of the cold boot attacks, they're actually pretty simple. That new type of attack targets computers running full disk encryption software. It turns out the contents of RAM don't just vanish when you cut power to it. It takes a few minutes. So these guys from Princeton University and the EFF figured out that they could read the encryption keys used by hard disk encryption products from memory if they yanked out the DRAM chips and plugged them into another computer with the right software, and they did that pretty quickly. Now, if you cool the memory with a liquid spray beforehand, before you yank it out, the RAM contents will last even longer. In all these cases, well, in most cases, an attacker would need physical access to a running or a sleep system to make this attack work. Funnily enough, anyone using a trusted platform module chip to load the keys into memory before a password was entered, they're actually vulnerable. So the TPM chip makes them more vulnerable in that case, not less. But, you know, if you've configured your full disk encryption software to require pre-boot authentication before it loads keys into memory, you're actually fine. This cold boot attack has raised the issue of hacking systems that you have physical access to again. So that made Adam's FireWire attack quite relevant again. So I chatted to him about why he's releasing his tool now, about the cold boot attacks, TPM, and a bunch of other stuff. And I started off by asking him to explain how his attack works and why he's prepared to release the Windows workstation attack now.
Well, it's a tool that I wrote when I was working on the FireWire stuff that I released at RuxCon a couple of years ago. Via the FireWire stuff I was demoing, you could gain access to the memory of a remote system via FireWire. Obviously, you could read memory with that, and you could write memory with that, and you could, if you were sufficiently cunning, do relatively evil things with it. So, of course, we, being somewhat evil people, wrote a tool, myself and Brett Moore, that would allow you to, among other things, unlock a locked Windows machine or log in without a password or spawn a administrator shell at the login prompt without having to log in, merely by plugging in your FireWire cable and running a command. So this was a tool that I developed, and we demoed it, or I demoed it at RuxCon, but we chose not to release it at the time because Microsoft was a little cagey about exactly whether FireWire memory access was a real security issue or not, and we didn't want to cause any real trouble. But, it's a couple of years have passed, and I think everyone has agreed that it's a feature rather than a bug, and hence I think it's about time to release it.
Hooray.
With the discussions of physical access attacks around the media at the moment, it's I guess it's a good time.
One thing I wondered about the FireWire thing, you said, I remember back in 2006 when you first came up with this password reset tool, you said that a lot of these tools that are designed to actually lock down FireWire ports are a little bit ineffective. Do you have a shame list or?
Well, of the tools that I tested that purported to, lock down USB ports and FireWire ports, some worked and some didn't. And in general, the ones that didn't work were the ones that allowed you to configure specific devices to be permitted or specific classes of devices. So you had some of the software said, for example, you're allowed to have FireWire video cameras but not FireWire disks. And obviously the secret sauce in the stuff that I demoed at RuxCon was the ability to lie about what you were over FireWire.
I am a camera, not a bearded Unix freak, that sort of thing.
Exactly, yeah. You literally just set a little descriptor flag that says, hi, I'm totally an iPod. and at that point, Microsoft lets you in. So yeah, all the pieces of software I looked at, ones that completely disabled the FireWire worked, and ones that allowed more granular control didn't.
Now, getting onto those cold boot attacks that you just mentioned, really this doesn't do anything that your FireWire attack doesn't do, right?
Well, no, not really, no, it doesn't. It's another way of getting access to the memory of a machine. It's, I guess, a little more crude because it's read-only, whereas my FireWire attack allows you to have write access to the memory.
So you reset the password to, like, A or whatever.
Yeah, or in the case of the WinLock Pwn tool, it just overwrites the code branch which tests the password to say, hey, well, any password's fine with me, man, that's cool.
Okay.
As Microsoft said, right, physical access is always going to win, and memory resonance has been known about for a long time. But I think the reason that this is interesting is that they have developed a practical, workable, usable attack that they can demonstrate to people who don't really have the technical nous to understand the specifics. But they can demonstrate the real-world risk.
I believe you actually sat down with a friend of yours and fairly well-known crypto researcher, Peter Goodman, and he found himself quite interested in one aspect of these cold boot attacks. What was that?
Well, I mean, obviously Peter has done quite a bit of work in this area, so he has a professional interest in it. But he thought that one of the most interesting things that they demonstrated was the ability to recover crypto keys from the key scheduling algorithm data in memory.
Okay, can we have that in English?
So the when the key material is used in the algorithm, it gets expanded effectively into a larger amount of data that's derived from the key. And so that effectively acts as kind of an error correcting code when we're recovering the data. It acts as an error correcting code for the key material itself. So we can afford to lose 15% of the bits and still be able to recover the key because it's been expanded in a known way to produce the data for the key scheduling algorithm.
And what are the ramifications for that, or is it too early to say?
In this particular case, obviously it allows them to recover the key material despite losing some reasonable percentage of bits out of memory.
I was actually wondering how that worked, and you've just explained it, so good.
But outside of this, I guess it's important anytime you're going to be looking at places where key material is stored, and we can extract data through some kind of side channel or, where there's a way to look at some portions of data relating to cryptographic processes. So I think it's an interesting area of study, and this is, I think, an important piece of work And certainly this was Peter's opinion, that is an important piece of work towards understanding, you know, how we get information out of the intermediate steps of cryptographic processes.
One of the things that I think is particularly funny about this cold boot thing is that computers loaded with their new whiz-bang trusted platform module chips are actually the ones that are most vulnerable to the cold boot attacks. Can you tell us why that is?
Well, I mean, the TPM design is meant to protect against attacks from the bootloader and during initialization of the operating system. So, I mean, they're kind of addressing issues that were interesting in 1982, you know, boot sector viruses, that sort of thing. So, you know, the TPM is not designed to prevent access, you know, prevent a threat where you have access to main memory. That's always going to be a winning environment for people.
Just for those out there who haven't actually read up on it, what it basically means is the TPM chip will load crypto keys into memory when you've actually just powered on your machine, so you don't need to enter a secret. And it's obviously not the best config, and Microsoft, to its credit, has been advising against that config, but it's just a nice little bit of irony, really, that a TPM chip designed to make your computer more secure is actually making it less secure.
In the specific case of when they're using it to get the keys for the disk without you having to enter a password, well, I mean, obviously any time where you don't have to enter a password is going to end up in badness, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, logic would tell us that. But do you know of any other research that, you know, you've been looking into when it comes to physical security and physical access?
Well, I mean, there's lots of classic research, you know, around defending things like ATM machines and, you know, machines that have to operate in hostile environments, you know, military crypto gear, all that sort of stuff. But that's so far out of the league of, you know, normal commercial business computing.
Well, and there are also devices that are limited to very specific uses, like enter PIN. You know, it's easy to create a very basic state machine that governs their usage, whereas with a computer, it's not really the case, is it?
Well, I mean, you know, the PC is basically an open general-purpose platform, and, you know, that's a very, very different threat model to, you know, a specialized piece of equipment like an ATM crypto processor.
Now, if I took a computer, loaded up Vista, and to Microsoft's credit, BitLocker has actually remained, in essence, unbroken, which is pretty amazing considering it's a Microsoft security feature. You load that onto your system, you're using pre-boot authentication, which means your keys aren't loaded into memory. When you boot, you have to enter a secret first, and you keep your laptop switched off or in hibernation mode when you're lugging it around. Now, surely that challenges the proposition that the game is over when someone has physical access.
Off, yes.
Well, that's the first time we can really say that, isn't it?
Well, yes
it's
and
the
no.
First, it's the first time that full disk encryption has actually been a practical and easily deployed solution. That's really come about in the last couple of years.
Yes, I absolutely agree with you there, yes. And attacks against, you know, most business systems that are using full disk encryption, other than these sort of attacks where the machine is on or suspended or in hibernate, you know, attacks against off machines really are limited to kind of double handling attacks where I can go into your office, you know, Trojan the BIOS or, you know, some pre-boot configuration aspect of your machine, go away again, wait for you to enter the crypto keys, come back again, steal it again. You know, like that sort of double handling. Then there's options there, but no, I mean, in terms of just stealing an off laptop that has full disk encryption, we're in a much, much better place than we were even 6 months ago.
One of the interesting things too is you wonder what the ramifications are for the data center, because that is the one place where you're not going to use pre-boot authentication, are you? Because
turn your machines off.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you get a power outage or, you know, a forced reboot or whatever, you don't want to have someone physically in the data center to actually type in a password. You want it to boot up to a login screen. Now, that's more of a worry, isn't it? Your physical access to your machines in your data center, it's pretty much game over.
Yeah, and I guess most people who buy, you know, commercial-grade data center hosting, I assume that they have some degree of physical security because they're in a data center. As to how much real security that buys you, you know, but from some guy walking in with a router under his arm and an ID badge, you know, you hear stories about people wandering through data centers and, you know, poking around finding root shells on the console. So, you know,
well, even people who boot stuff into single user mode or even just rent rack space in the next rack, you know.
Well, exactly right. If your budget, you know, if your attacker's budget goes as far as renting rack space in the same colo facility, then you're in a pretty bad place, I guess.
Can I just describe my favorite attack in the data center? And I think it's a really cool one. Hardware keyloggers.
Yeah, well, that's certainly a very viable attack in an environment like that.
I mean, you got a device that's about the size of the front joint of your finger, you know, that just goes between the computer and the KVM connection and captures all your keystrokes. You put
and
it
increasingly,
in,
people are using IP KVMs or, you know, management solutions over the network with, you know, the blade chassis kit, that sort of thing. If you've got physical access to the data center, then maybe it's easier to drop yourself onto the management network and sniff the VNC traffic between the KVM and the, you know, the IP management, you know, the lights out management hardware on the devices.
Are they still using weakest piss crypto on their passwords?
Presumably, yes. I mean, most of the embedded implementations, I'm sure, are terrible.
Adam Boileau from Immunity Inc. there, and you can download his attack tool by following the links from itradio.com.au/security, or you can go straight to storm.net.nz. It's time now for this week's sponsor interview with Checkpoint Software's Frederick Boyerson, a business development manager in the Asia-Pacific region. He was keen to have a chat about what these proposed data loss disclosure laws in Australia might mean. If you haven't heard, the Australian Law Reform Commission is looking at introducing data loss disclosure laws similar to what they have in the United States and Europe. And apparently most markets are ahead of us, including Asian markets. So we're playing a bit of catch-up.
Yes, they're much stricter than they are here. And same goes for Japan and same goes for the US. So I guess one of the main things that the Australian government is looking into doing is really forcing Australian businesses to be more proactive when it comes to IT and security especially. And by forcing them to be more proactive, they'll take the steps that they thought companies would take when they made changes here in 2001, I believe.
Everywhere where we've seen data loss disclosure laws introduced, one of the results of the introduction of those laws is that everyone all of a sudden starts using full disk encryption on laptops.
Well, that's one part of it. The main thing is really making sure that we put the same level of protection of information regardless of where it's stored. So if we wind back the tape a bit on when we started to process information in various types of IT environments, everyone started investing heavily into network security. And now we have everyone going mobile, or over the last couple of years we've had people going mobile and using various types of tools to communicate safely with the network. But of course we need to take the same steps on making sure that information is safeguarded regardless of where it's stored. So full disk encryption is one part of it, making sure that you're protecting yourself against malicious software is another part of it, having a safe network connection is another part of it. So it's essentially replicating the same level of protection we have for information stored in networks when it's stored on mobile devices, which is laptops, mobile phones, DVDs, CDs, and USB memories.
Obviously, this is something that vendors really welcome because it helps drive investment in kit. But I mean, that's not to say that this is you know, purely a cynical ploy on behalf of vendors for welcoming this. These laws make a lot of sense, don't they?
They make a lot of sense, and the best thing about these laws is that they force companies and organizations from being proactive with sort of a holistic security approach. It's not about mobile devices only, it's about network security, it's about policies, processes, and procedures, and it's to force businesses and organizations to take the steps that they should.
I suppose, look, one other interesting aspect to this is it's, and I hate using this word because Australian politicians love using it and it's sort of become a bit meaningless, but it is an outcomes-based law. It doesn't really matter what steps you've taken to protect your information to be compliant. Really, at the end of the day, in order to be compliant with this law, if you lose information, it doesn't matter how that happens, you have to disclose it.
Exactly, which is, of course, a good thing from a consumer point of view, because to me, it doesn't really matter how someone lost my information or what steps they took. If they didn't keep pace with technology developments on the security front and developments on sort of the hacker and the malicious IT user and organized crime side, if my personal details are lost, I'm in serious pain for a long time and the rest of my life because of that. And it doesn't really matter if they had an antivirus system or a personal firewall. I want them to make sure that my details are safe for how, you know, whenever, however.
Don't you think in the past, though, that the, I suppose our compliance regimes have been flawed in that sense, where they haven't really penalised people for losing data, they've penalised them for not taking steps A, B, C, and D to protect their data?
I actually don't know of any details of penalties at all in Australia. However, I do know that if we compare this this Privacy Act that we have in effect in Australia now with the Privacy Acts that we have in other countries, both in Asia-Pacific and in other parts of the world, the Australian privacy law is really toothless. There's no legislation with a baseball bat, so to say. If something goes wrong, there's no serious consequence for a business here, which means that businesses have not yet been, motivated into taking these decisions yet.
And you really think that'll change?
That will really change, because all businesses know that if they're forced to make a breach notification in any form, if their business name is associated with something as bad as losing lots of personal details on consumers or something in that range, if that's spread out through the press in a TV show or through a press announcement or something like that, if that's associated with a business name, it's very bad for business. And various research done overseas shows that many customers choose to leave this type of company that cannot protect their personal details.
Okay, so we know that that's an angle to it, which is the erosion of goodwill that comes from these sorts of incidents. But do you expect that there'll be any actual solid penalties introduced with this legislation?
Again, it's difficult to say what the new government will do. I do expect this new government, being a Labour government, to look after the individual. And I do expect them to force businesses in making sound decisions on IT and security. But I guess it's something that we'll see when the Australian Law Reform Committee has submitted their report to the Attorney General, and it's been passed through to Parliament. So within 3 to 5 months or so, we'll see solid answers on where we're heading. But I do expect that this government will take steps to make sure that we're protected as individuals here in Australia.
How much of these data? I mean, there's got to be data loss incidents in Australia that are going unreported. I mean, do you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. It's something that happens to all businesses all the time. Laptops go missing, USB memories go missing, cell phones go missing, and it's really difficult to actually put any type of figure on it. If we look at sort of how many consumers' details that might have been lost here in Australia because of the fact that we don't have any in a breach notifications or disclosure acts, but we do know that these things happen all the time, and it seems to be so that the current easiest path, the path of least resistance, is really for the governments and organizations and any type of businesses to deal with it on an individual basis, possibly assist the individuals who put through any type of difficulties because of a breach on a case-by-case basis, and help them out by simply paying them the amounts that might have been extracted from their accounts or because of fraud that might have happened.
Well, I guess there's going to have to be penalties for people who actually lose some data and then don't report it. I mean, that's a given. But I guess what I'm wondering here as well is, do you think we will see a raft of disclosures, data loss disclosures, as soon as this law becomes effective?
I don't think we'll see lots of them immediately. As I've understood the work that's been done so far by the ALRC, the Privacy Commissioner would look into what types of breaches that have happened, and the Privacy Commissioner would work with these organizations when it's appropriate to make a disclosure or not. So I'm not expecting a flood of breach messages to hit the market in 6 to 8 months or so. We are expecting the Privacy Commissioner to have more powers, and we're expecting the Privacy Commissioner to work with these organizations, making sure that they make the right type of disclosures when they do happen.
Okay, well, Fred, thank you for that preview of what the regime might look like, and thanks for speaking to Risky Business.
Thank you.
This time, I'm not here to stay.
Checkpoint Software's Fred Boyerson there with this week's sponsor interview. And that's it for this week's edition of Risky Business. This week's Sound Foundation track is by Diana Arnaid, and you can buy it for $1.30 from soundfoundation.com.au. And that's an MP3, no DRM crap in it. Now, I said their tracks were $1.70 last week, but that was wrong, sorry. But yeah, $1.30 at soundfoundation.com.au. And this song's called Blues Singer. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.